Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mark Christensen. This is show 34, and this week we're going to look at Cloverfield, the box office sensation of January 2008. I'm joined today by David. How's
Hello.
It going?
It goes quite well, actually. How about yourself?
I'm fine. So, David, Cloverfield, were you, I know you were really looking forward to this one beforehand. I recollect that. And were you as psyched after seeing it as you were before?
If anything, I was more psyched after seeing it than I was before. I loved this movie. I saw it twice opening weekend. I thought it was absolutely awesome.
All right. Well, I'm not going to disagree with you. I actually, I confess to sometimes being kind of a film snob, and this is just the kind of thing I might have waited for the DVD. And I imagine we have listeners who also sort of decided to give it a pass based on its seeming lack of story and so on. But I think it's a little subtler than that. We'll probably get into that a little later. But just to focus on visual effects and it's kind of the type of movie is, well, first of all, I mean, would you call this a creature feature? Like, do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean by that. This is a movie that it kind of sticks its toe into a lot of different genres of movie. You know, at some point you could consider a creature movie. At some points you could consider a disaster movie. I actually think in terms of, and this, I hope everyone who is listening to this isn't going to mind a few spoilers along the way.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking about that.
The genre of movie that this reminds me most of is actually a zombie movie. And not that there's zombies in the movie, because there aren't. But let me explain. In a zombie movie, you know, life is going along normal. All of a sudden, oh my God, there are zombies. And you're with a small group of people who are running from this ever-advancing force that you can't stop, and one by one they die.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the movie, oh my God, everyone's dead. And that's kind of what happened in this movie, with the people that were with, pretty much, except for one person who you don't even know her end fate, wound up dead at the end of the movie at the hands of this unstoppable force.
Right. And for those, by the way, who haven't seen the movie and are really truly worried about spoilers, and honestly I hate them too, I avoid looking at trailers even to sometimes, because sometimes you can't avoid it, but I do sometimes avoid looking at trailers, and for the very reason that I like to come to a movie fresh. In this case, you know, this movie does have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I think we'll leave it to the end of the show to talk about the writing on it. Get your perspective as a WGA person. We'll bookend the show with the writing stuff. But, you know, I don't think it's really not about that. In fact, in a sense, they give away the movie at the beginning. You know, they set it up as a memory of a place that used to be called Central Park. And so you
yeah,
kind of, you get a pretty heavy clue right off the bat that everything you see that's all happy and fine at the beginning is ephemeral. And
yeah,
is doomed. The zombie perspective is interesting. I mean, it reminded me, when I say creature feature, I'm thinking of
like the Blob,
you know,
or Creature from the Black
Gamera, Lagoon. Yeah, Godzilla, the bigger, you know, Godzilla versus Bambi. No, but the a film like Them, which I think, or Obey, I think there, some of these films, I think they even snuck posters of these films into this movie, because at the very end of the credits, they credited poster art for a couple of these old movies. And they're also the kind of movies we generally associate with Japan.
Right.
Or the Far East in general. I mean, the one that comes to mind most recently is The Host, which is quite a different movie, but has more in common with this one than anything I can think of coming out of Hollywood anytime recently. I don't know about you.
I think so, definitely.
But you're saying it also makes you think of 28 Days Later and that type of film?
Well, it doesn't make me think of that in terms of, you know, it's about horror and gore and that kind of thing. But, you know, in your traditional monster movie, your heroes at the end of it are left standing victorious over the monster.
Gotcha.
And in this movie, they lose.
I follow you. Yeah.
So like, and I, that's like the staple of the zombie genre as a general rule, is that they lose.
If there is a surprise in this film, and this is one that we will give away here, it's that there's not just the big monster. There are also little creepier monsters, and the creators of the thing acknowledge that having a movie where you're just up against one big monster is really hard from a character progression point of view because, there's just this monolithic thing to try to figure out how to kill. Whereas if you have a more immediate and intimate threat, you can do more with that.
Yeah, well, they did the same thing in that remake of Godzilla that came out, what was it, 97, 98, Roland Emmerich's film, where they had the hatchlings, that were kind of like the Velociraptor things. But on a philosophical level, comparing this to Godzilla, I think, is a really smart move, because Godzilla was kind of Japan's reaction to having the atomic bomb dropped on them. And in a lot of ways, this movie is a reaction to 9/11.
Which is its most controversial element. And I think, well, that's really what I kind of want to get to toward the end here. So let's just talk about the effects. We had two studios, I think just two total, but two primary studios anyway, working on this. All the creatures were done at Tippett. And then DNEG, Digital Negative.
Double negative.
Oh, I'm sorry, double negative. Thank you. So they were chosen to do the all the rest of the effects, and they had done projects. I was just looking down the list, even though I didn't get their name right. I have their credits. They did World Trade Center, Children of Men, United 93, and Kevin Blank, who's the VFX supervisor, said that he chose them because he saw this film as oddly kind of a combination of all three of those.
Right. They also did a lot of the work on Gotham City in Batman Begins, and I think they're very similar to ImageWorks in that, they're known to an extent for doing these, full green screen replacements of an entire city and environment. They kind of got their start on. Oh, what was that movie? The original before they did Chronicles of Riddick. They were doing those creatures in that movie that were, but then they've kind of evolved a lot into doing. They still do a lot of creature work and character work, but they do these amazing full set replacements that are quite spectacular in this movie, especially given the budget.
Indeed. For some reason, I'm totally drawing a blank on what you're fishing for there, but I'll give you a second to try to IMDb it if you want and just talk about the shooting style in this movie, which is another controversial element of it. I don't, did you feel like, well, we'll get to this in a second. So, one thing that's well known about this film is that it's full of really blurry handheld shots. And in fact, there were reports from some people that they had to leave the theater after the first third of it because it's so kind of makes you so carsick trying to watch these things on the big screen. And it also left me at least feeling with the creatures like I never really got a good look at them. Did you have that sense?
I did, and that's what I really liked about the movie from a story point. By the way, the movie I was thinking of is Pitch Black.
Oh, okay.
But I like the fact that you don't get a good, clear look at the creatures the whole way through. I think this is an incredibly, for having a 90-foot tall monster, I think it's the most realistic way you can make that kind of film. Because what I don't like about those kind of, your Godzillas is you have the person who's just going about their daily life, and then they get involved in this situation, and all of a sudden the government and the military are telling this person all the information, and they have all the information as to where this monster
Oh.
came from and why they're here, and
You're
oh,
talking about all that bad exposition stuff.
it's not just bad exposition, but it's why would the army involve this random civilian in their fight? They wouldn't.
Will Smith.
Yeah,
Right.
so
He wasn't a civilian,
I
but yeah.
like the idea that these the people you are following in the movie are just, they have no clue what's going on, so you as an audience member really shouldn't have a clue as to what's going on. So while the movie is about this monster attacking New York, the movie's about really about these people who are caught up in that event.
Right.
And it's not, I love the fact it does not digress into, oh my God, here's where the monster came from. And
Yeah.
while you could think that it's weak on the part of the filmmakers that they didn't think that up, if you delve into a little bit of
Oh, right. No, they actually did think a lot about it, and
yeah.
it's almost a mystery that they did because, let's talk about that and a few other behind the scenes things about this. I actually was just going to say, Blair Witch Project comes to mind as another film of this, I think of this decade, right? We're still, that was
Yeah.
still. And
Barely.
obviously, right. And that one, I think after the first week, people were seeing it and kind of going, groaning and wondering what the big deal was about because the bubble had kind of burst on its ability to get your imagination going. You were waiting for the big surprise. Whereas in this one, I think they were a little cleverer than that. And it did a kind of War of the Worlds thing. And I'm talking about the original radio cast of War of the Worlds, where I think it shows you relatively little to let your imagination do more. It's the George Lucas Star Wars trick as well.
Yeah, I mean, this film, I think, will be studied by marketing classes in colleges, like for the next few years, as to how you construct a viral marketing campaign. The only thing this movie had going for it is it had a very enigmatic trailer attached to a movie that everyone was going to see in its target demographic, which is
Which was Transformers.
which is Transformers.
Yeah.
I remember I went and saw Transformers on the day it came out, saw this trailer, and I was like, I have no idea what that is, but I have to go see it now.
Yeah, and it was untitled, right? They
Yeah,
didn't even tell you what the trailer was for.
had no title on it. All I knew is it had a bad robot vanity card on it, which meant it was J.J. Abrams, which meant it was okay in my book. It has that seal of approval, and I was like, okay, I want to find out. And then about a week and a half later, I found out, because we were talking about this trailer at work, and found out that Neville Page, who is the creature designer on Avatar, the film I'm working on, also was the creature designer on this. And he was like, yeah, I'm working on that, and I can't tell you anything about it.
Yeah, just like Avatar.
Exactly. So fair is fair, but
Yeah, now it's okay. So Neville Page was the one responsible for giving this monster this whole other vulnerable story, right? Like the monster is meant to, he's new, he was just born. Yeah, you.
it's not that Neville came up with that story.
Oh, okay.
It's the writer and director, because a lot of this movie was improv. It was there was a script, but the script was kind of laid out, from what I've been able to gather, in much the same way that Curb Your Enthusiasm, the show on HBO, is laid out, where they have the beats as to in the scene, this is going to happen, this is going to happen, and you need to say this line, and you need to say this line, but everything else in the scene, to a large extent, is improvised. But all the JJ, who came up with the story on the film, and Drew Goddard, they had this whole idea of this monster. He's not, chomping down on New York City because he hates New York. Their idea is that this is a newborn creature who got lost, and is just confused and scared, and these things are all around him attacking him, and he doesn't know why. From
Yeah.
what the idea is, was basically presented, is what would happen if you took a human baby and put him on an ant hill? The ants would probably go and try to swarm all over this baby and bite him, and he would get annoyed and swat the ants and smash the ant hill, and that's the exact same thing. It's just taken to where the ants.
Right, or the elephant who gets frightened and lashes out at the circus, too many bright
Exactly.
lights in his face. These examples in what I read in the show notes were attributed to Neville Page, but I'm sure you're right that they came out of a whole discussion with J.J. Abrams, who, from Lost, clearly specializes in this type of spectacle marketing and also these crazy deep backstories that may or may not ever truly come across, and yet you can't argue with them. Like, after seeing the movie, you don't say, well, no, that's total BS. That wasn't even in there. I think, it just creates a layer that's almost subconscious to the film.
Yeah, it's a nice, where there's a completeness to it that if you are really involved in the film, if you can go as deep as you want. I also like the fact that there's, concurrences between the different universes. There's a, the guy, the main character of the film, he's going to Japan to work for the Slusho.
Slusho,
Which Slusho Soda Company or whatever it's
right.
called, which is also appears in Lost.
Yeah, it goes beyond an inside joke a little bit.
I think someone told me I didn't make it out in the film, but someone told me that the plane tickets he has to Japan are on Oceanic Airlines, which is
Funny.
where they do these little in jokes or completeness to their fans that I think kind of adds that extra, as long as it doesn't get too gimmicky,
Yeah.
adds a nice layer to the film.
I think it makes it more fun for effects artists to work on these things too. I mean, this is just the kind of thing, from what I know of Phil Tippett, that he loves. He loves a soulful, destructive monster. That's right up his alley.
He loves it.
I mean, he
He
kind of lives for
absolutely.
that stuff.
That was the the thing that popped into my mind almost when I saw, I don't know what they're called, the parasites or whatever, is they reminded me to an extent of Starship Troopers,
Right.
the creatures in that. But I think, because you mentioned it earlier, I think with the filmmaking style, we should really mention the match moving on the film.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, you probably read this as well about the D-Next screening where they gave a standing O to their lead match
Yeah,
mover. Yeah,
and
well, and that could be a slightly cringeworthy addition to some of the trends this movie is setting. But go ahead.
well, actually, if you kind of the filmmakers knew what they were getting into, they knew the style of film that they were going to be doing, and they talked it over with the visual effects people, but the one of the nice things that they did is they realized how much of a headache they were causing
Indeed.
for the for the effects guys, and
Right.
they tried to make it as easy as possible, but without having to say they said we're going to be filming it in this style, we're going to be filming it with these cameras,
Right.
everything
So
else is up to you. But one of the things that like on set when they have a green screen, sometimes the visual effects guys will get 20 minutes, a half hour, to kind of map out the set, take their photos, put markers on the green screen, and that's it. These guys
yeah.
were given 2 or 3 days beforehand access to the sets to put as many markers as they wanted on the green screen, to take as many reference photographs as they needed, to just, they're like, okay, we realize we're completely screwing you guys, but we're going to try to help you out beforehand.
Yeah, now they were also allowed to make a call on what type of camera was used for their shots. The original concept called for the whole thing to be done with HD camcorders, and in fact, the FD-1AVC HD was used for those first scenes, the Coney Island sequence, the girlfriend stuff. And then, as soon as we were into effects shots, those shots were all taken either with the Sony F23 Sony Alta or the Viper, which they insisted on because of both the contrast range that they needed to, match effects into some pretty mostly dark shots, and also just to get those motion tracks out of them.
Yeah, and to grade it. One of the things they also did is they attached a lipstick camera
Yes.
to the camera
Yeah, talk about that one. That's great.
I don't know if you've ever done any tracking. I'm sure you have.
Right, to get the focal length. So they were going so run and gun that they had to use a second camera to just look at the focal ring on. They were always using zoom lenses. They used no primes. And just so they'd have some reading as they're on the run, shooting 4 or 5 minute long takes of what the focal length was. I take it they were using cameras that weren't recording this information.
Yeah,
That's
they.
how they did it.
Yeah, it was there's ways you can attach specific devices to cameras in order to record all that information coming out of the camera, but
Yeah, there are recording formats that'll do it now, but they're a little bit few and far between still.
yeah, and I don't think those cameras support them. There's external devices you can attach to some cameras that will record that as well, but
But
with
no
this.
good for run and gun.
No good for run and gun. So just, your friend Stu Mashowitz, this whole movie kind of fits into his whole philosophy of being a rebel filmmaker, of, getting a simple solution to a complex problem.
I agree. They also had several shots that were taken by one of the actors. At least according to TJ Miller, who played HUD, he said he shot about a third of the movie and they used about half of his shots. And I assume they gave him the HVX 200.
Yeah, which I hear they auctioned off on
Yeah,
eBay,
right.
for less than $5,000, which is
Yeah,
it's a good price for an HVX.
exactly. It's a re it's yeah, there was no premium paid for getting the Cloverfield camera.
Yeah, but the idea of doing, a movie like Blair Witch, there were no effects in that movie.
Actually, come to think of it, maybe people figured if it was used on Cloverfield, it must have the crap beaten out of it,
Possibly,
right?
but in a movie like Blair Witch has had no effects in it. So doing that whole movie with a camcorder makes not well not maybe not makes sense, but it works. For a movie like this, you have to make some allowances for the fact that you are shooting green screen for a good share of your movie. You're gonna need that color depth and resolution that really only a high-end HD camera works, and then you can color grade it down and destroy the footage that you want to make it look like a consumer camera.
Yeah, some professionals made the comment that the footage really looked too good to be camcorder footage, and it was as if somebody had one of these really nice cameras and just forgot to use image stabilization. But the truth is that, I mean, I was thinking about this, and just as film noir was the signature look of the 40s and 50s, and so sci-fi at that time might look like the Twilight Zone, nowadays, I think you could make a strong argument that handheld, blurry, real time is really, in very many ways, the look of our era.
I think so as well.
Which means we might be stuck with films like this for a while. If you don't like the handheld look, brace yourself for the next decade because we may see more of these. Also, because this film was a smash success. I think it was made for $25 or $30 million, and it made more than that in the opening weekend just in the US.
Yeah, it was I heard it was a budget at $25 million, and it came in on time and under budget, which is, considering everything put into it, was amazing, and it made $45 million in its opening weekend, which is an unqualified success by anyone's means. The interesting thing is, I heard that they are making a sequel by doing
Right.
it as a another group on the same night.
Yeah.
So you can make an infinite number of these films, and once you watch them all together, you'll get an idea of what the movie, like what the monster's about.
One theory about that is that there is one scene on the Brooklyn Bridge where you see another guy with a camera pointing it at the stars of this film, and that could be the crisscrossing moment where the two dramas intersect. Let's finish with the effects and the visuals, and we'll talk more about the story and the characters, because I think in a funny way, these characters are put in this film merely because they happen to be the ones living on the street where the head of the Statue of Liberty came tumbling along. They don't seem that essential to the story, but I'm trying to be disciplined and stick to visual effects before we go off into that. Other trends that I spotted that we could see from this film visually, well, this isn't exactly a visual one. This film is relatively short. It's a fast ride. It's less than an hour and a half long. The fact that it's a small budget movie, another monster movie that's been made recently that on the complete other end of the scale was Van Helsing. And, we could spend some time just reeling out the differences between this film and that. But I think, in the time we've already spent on it, we've thrown out quite a few. It's almost night and day different from that movie.
I mean, this is a very, very, very real movie in every level. I personally was, and it didn't even hit me till afterwards when I was, after I'd seen it the first time, the way they handled the flashbacks in this movie was one of the most brilliant, creative editorial choices I've ever seen, where.
Simply by having the tape have segments of it that hadn't been recorded over.
Yeah, where, but they would tie it in brilliantly. Where, they would talk about subject A, and then they're like, "Here, I'll show you on the camera," or he'd fall at that point. That would cause a problem with the recording mechanism on the camera. That would give you like, a minute or 20 seconds of a flashback to previously recorded on the tape. That would tie into what they were just talking about.
And also gave you a little bit of a break from the grim march to destruction that these guys are on. As fun as it was, because this movie's a fun ride, I felt.
Yeah, absolutely. But the thing is, and I didn't even notice this till my second screening when someone pointed out to me to look for it. The last flashback of the movie. And again, if you haven't seen the movie, well, it's spoiled by now, so well, there's that shot of them at Coney Island, and if you look out in the water, like it's not the camera doesn't focus on it, but in the corner periphery of the lens, there's a small little that hits the water,
Something just drops in there.
and the thing is, get to the effects of that, in an effects movie, if you said in the script, okay, we have a thing item hitting the water, that's going to be, bid out as a pretty elaborate, expensive shot with
Money shot, right?
with dynamic simulations, and oh, we're going to have to get a custom fluid renderer, and
Right, but they meant it to be more like a UFO sighting where you almost can't be sure that you even saw anything.
you can't see anything. It's but because the what the camera's actually shooting at that point, it's not that. It's not about that. But that I think in an talking about as an effect, the fact that it doesn't draw your eye to it, that it's a big effect. It's not an invisible effect, but it is an invisible effect. And it's one of those
Understood.
things that add those layers to the movie that I really appreciated.
Now, what else did you see as signature effects shots in this movie?
I think the money shot of the monster from the helicopter.
Right, that would be it.
I think that was like the shot that probably was 1/25th of the budget. Right there, you have probably an all digital shot of New York City with all digital buildings and a gigantic full screen digital monster rampaging with explosions and everything like that. That to me, and that was your first big reveal of here's what the monster looks like.
Now that one is very elaborate and very CG. I really respected how many of the shots were done with natural photography and including I know the collapsed building sequence. They really tried as much as they could not to do that with 3D, using a matte painting for the building itself. And then once they were up there, they did a green screen shot of the top of this collapsed building, and then a 360 cyclorama around them, done from photos, which I think they had to sneak into a restaurant in Manhattan to get the angle that they wanted. They actually had to take those photos while they were having an expensive meal and waiting until the waiter wasn't there.
To photograph out the windows, I had heard that as well. That shot actually was the one shot, not the The matte painting. I thought the matte painting was gorgeous. The first, when they walk into the room and there's that collapsed room with the other building leaning against it, that they're about to have to crawl out on. That's the only scene in the movie that felt very sound stagey to me.
There was some big shift there. And I actually, when I saw it, thought, oh, here's where they switched to the HVX200, because all of a sudden it looked very video-y.
Right.
And yet I don't think that's true. They shot it on the green stage, I think they shot it with one of their high-end cameras. So yeah, there was something else about that that was kind of jarring at that moment.
My only thought that it could possibly be is that it was because there is so much green screen replacement going on, that shot was handled a little bit more stably, if that's even a word, than the others in terms of camera motion.
Could be.
I don't know what it is. I'm gonna have to really look at that scene when it comes out in DVD again and again to figure out. But there was a definite visual shift, in my opinion, and it went away after they left that room as well.
Yeah, I noticed that too. What about
And I love the
the
night vision shot in the tunnel when he looks up at the ceiling and he sees the crawly guys for the first time. With the night vision mode of the camera, and that whole little fight that they have there, I thought that was really, really well done. Well animated, well rendered, beautifully integrated, and again, amazing match moving.
Let's talk for a second about the destruction of the Brooklyn Bridge, and the tail lashing through there. We just did I Am Legend a little while ago, and you know, this fits into Mike Seymour's theory that Americans must hate New York because we keep destroying it over and over again. But as you said, this movie very consciously conjures 9/11, and in such a way that was pretty controversial. But before we go there, the Brooklyn Bridge, that was a green screen stage, 50-foot long section that they built in, I don't know, somewhere in LA. And I know one little piece of trivia is they had the actors drive their own cars onto it to be the stranded cars on the bridge.
Yep.
And then they had to rather painstakingly 3D model the rest of it, which starts to make me wonder how many times that kind of work is going to be redone. I guess they said it was, you know, not so bad in the sense that bridges follow patterns, and so you can repeat things. And they took a lot more trouble with the foreground detail than the background. And I know that they studied Tacoma Narrows bridge reference for the destruction of that.
Yeah, I thought the bridge destruction, the last bridge destruction that we saw in the film, there's I Am Legend, but you didn't really see, it wasn't really
Right.
f about the bridge destruction, but I think the last like hero bridge destruction we saw was the Golden Gate Bridge in X-Men 3.
Oh, well, yeah, okay, let's compare it to that.
And then we also saw the Brooklyn Bridge destroyed in the aforementioned Roland Emmerich's Godzilla. But there's apparently an insane amount of detail put into the model of that bridge, you know, with multiple levels of detail going backwards in depth, but you know, down to each individual bolt and nut was modeled
Right.
with beveling and you know, all the
Rust, layers of rust and
layers of rust and
exposed
all the threads
paint.
were modeled. And you know, big ups to the modelers on that to put that kind of detail and thought into, you know, making sure it looked real. And to be honest, the first time I watched that sequence, I didn't even see the creature's tail go by, you know, because I was concentrating on the actual characters who are doing their thing in that. Just I saw that something happened and it caused the bridge to collapse. But
Yeah.
the bridge collapse was very, very plausible, I thought.
I agree. For a Maya simulation, I really didn't think of it as such watching it. And we get a better look of it at it than we do. I mean, that section was better lit than a lot of where the creatures show up.
Right. Well, that's because the entire bridge is lit up at night.
Which
I kind of like the fact, from a filmmaking point of view, that you know, again, it ties into the style of the film, but because the camera was confined to To the viewpoint of the characters, it kept the bridge destruction very, if you pulled back to a wide establishing shot of the bridge falling apart, it has a better chance of looking fake, of looking like a simulation, or looking like, if this had been done 15 years ago, a model, falling apart. You have those issues of scale that you have to worry
Yep.
about with splashing water and fire and all that kind of stuff. But the way this was handled, it was probably the most plausible bridge destruction I've seen.
Yep. Agreed. Okay, well, we're not going to argue about that. I mean, I also know, there were other areas where they did have to fake it to make it. The Liberty head shot, I know they overscaled that thing because the real head is only 11 feet across and nobody was buying it that these people would be standing in the street next to the Liberty head and it would be only slightly taller than they are.
Yeah, I
And
actually.
that's just a case of letting, if it didn't look right to the majority of people who look at it, you have to change it. Go ahead.
That was a weird shot for me, 'cause it didn't look right to me. And it wasn't because of the size of it. Something about it, like, it didn't look green enough for me. I'm not sure exactly what it was. Maybe the fact that it was lying in the street kind of skewed my perspective, but something about that, it looked a little bit more like, I was surprised, honestly, when I found out it was purely digital, because I thought it was a prop that had been built and put there on stage. But the idea that was in my head when I saw it and I thought it looked a little off was, the prop guys built this and they didn't get it quite right, but oh well, we have to shoot the scene.
Oh, okay.
But
I mean, it's
yeah.
also an example where they conjured that shot as the money shot for the trailer and then didn't use the trailer shot whatsoever. They discarded it completely. It wasn't even done by the same house. And it sounds like one of those things where there was a lot of hand-wringing over this one and they labored it quite a bit. And maybe in the end it would have been simpler to just build it, to be honest, because it sounds like they just kept changing minds about scale and detail on it, and it kept getting more.
Right. I also thought that one of the on the building of the model, one of the things I thought was really interesting, in terms of that whole rebel mindset, is they worked from these high-res photographs they found on the internet. There's no big production's gonna pay money to go rent a helicopter to do laps around the Statue of Liberty so he can take these high-res photographs of it. This was quite literally something that anyone could do. Anyone with the talent and the tools, you could do this with a free copy of Blender and enough free time.
Yeah, and again, they were avoiding doing detailed 3D models of buildings in New York was their last resort. Photos really drove a lot of it.
Right. And I, they did some on-location filming and that kind of stuff. And the way, again, the way they made the movie, they were smart, where they would stick people in a room that was completely sealed off, or whatever, where you could get away with doing it on a sound stage or in a controlled location. But the destruction of the, I still don't know. Again, this is, gets back into the story of, we don't know what's going on. I have no idea how the Statue of Liberty got caught on fire. There's these flaming balls of the Statue of Liberty hitting New York City. It's never explained. And it's one of those, I would have thought that if, the Statue of Liberty is a hollow, very thin-skinned copper sculpture, I would think if it had been hurled, halfway across Manhattan to land in the street, it would have pancaked, possibly. But
Well, I think it went right through that building that exploded for some other unknown reason, right?
yeah, that, I
No, it's
mean,
hard to say.
it's gets into one of those things where I know visual effects artists argue with this all the time, which is, do I make it right or do I make it look like the director wants? And I'm
Yeah, it definitely needed to look cool. And I think this will be our closing discussion as well about conjuring this 9/11 imagery, which is something, you know, people were pretty, some critics were, and members of the public were morally outraged by this, which I think, I have a feeling we're not going to disagree about this, David, that this seems a little ridiculous. But it does raise a couple of questions. One, could this be tasteful? Like, could this be, I'm sorry, tasteless? Obviously, it can be tasteful in a film like United 93, which, frankly, the box office was nothing like this movie. So obviously, by tweaking people's feelings about 9/11, they're onto something good. And is that just a sign of tastelessness and lack of style?
Well, I don't think it has to do with tastelessness or lack of style. I could understand how it could offend people, but here's the problem you get into, and this ties exactly into our conversation we just had about the Statue of Liberty head. Unfortunately, we now know what it looks like for a major American city to be going under attack or being in the process of being destroyed. It's in our collective consciousness what this looks like. And as a effects artist who's striving for realism, you have if it didn't look like that, the audience would have known. They possibly wouldn't have consciously known, but in their heads it would have been like, well, that doesn't look real. Like, I know what a collapsing building looks like. I know what it looks like when there's all this dust and debris in the air of a street. It's we know it. You know, if you had to do a movie about a city that gets flooded, unfortunately, it's going to call back to Katrina or to the Indonesian tsunami. You know, we know now our society has cameras everywhere, whether it's camcorders, whether it's 24-hour news media or whatever. Whenever there's an event happens, there's tons and tons of video footage of it that gets shown around the clock, and it enters into our brains, and we now know what that looks like.
Right. Now, a cloud of dust rolling down a street with people running to try to get out of it is, you know, an iconic image, as you're saying. The question is, you know, I don't think we're going to argue that the effects should have been more fake to make it more palatable. Although, frankly, I think it would have made it more palatable. I think that something about 50s monster movies is they were always so phony that, in a way, the only, you know, I was probably the only one who got scared of creature features because I was still in my single digit years when it was on late night television. And so it was what the big kids watched, and I was scared of it. But if I had, you know, been able to discern, I would have looked at it and gone, well, that's a rubber Godzilla. But this ability to use those kind of images for what's basically just a fun monster movie is obviously confusing for some people.
I think it is, and you know, recently one of the premium cable channels has been rerunning Deep Impact, which is a movie I hadn't thought about in a few years.
No, why
And
would you?
but the there's a shot in that movie, you know, after the first comet hits the Earth and the tidal wave comes in and you know, takes out the East Coast. You know, there's this tidal wave going down New York. You know, it takes out the Statue of Liberty, and then it takes out the two towers of the World Trade Center. And it's one of those things where I'm sure they couldn't have shown that movie on TV 5 years ago. They would have gotten letters and complaints and everything like that. But it's again, it falls in. You look at a movie like Independence Day that had a sequence of, again, New York getting destroyed, where you had these gigantic balls of fire traveling up the street, consuming people. Is that any better than clouds of dust, or is that worse? I mean, we now know what a building collapsing looks like. It has those, you know, the streets act like chimneys, drawing the dust along them. We just know what it looks like, and we have a responsibility as visual effects artists to suspend the audience's disbelief and make them buy what we're showing them. make them believe
Yeah,
it.
and I mean, I think the maybe I have to make these the closing thoughts about this. This film also fits in with something like Children of Men, where it's telling an Armageddon story that is really pretty tangential to any real Armageddon story that we should all sit around and be worried about. I don't think too many of us are really worried that a Cloverfield-type monster is about to pop out of the Hudson Bay.
Speak for yourself.
Okay, fine. And you know, similarly, Children of Men, well, if the birth rate is going to go to zero, it hasn't happened yet. But the sense of, as you were alluding to earlier, of the age we live in and the type of anxieties that we have, make that combination of Armageddon and dust clouds rolling down the street and buildings exploding in the sky, pretty potent. And clearly it tweaked some people's nerve endings.
Yeah, and I think
So
the
I'd say good job for
I say good
that.
job to everyone involved in this movie. My final thoughts on the movie are, this was an awesome movie. I was with it from moment one to the end of the movie. Speaking of the end of the movie, I do want to say one of the things I really appreciated as a filmmaker, and it might have had to do with how short the movie was or how low budget it was, so therefore not a lot of people. If you watch the credits of this movie, you can actually read every single name of every single person who worked on this movie.
Ah, good point.
They scroll by at a speed that is reasonable, that they aren't 12 names across in 1-point font. I as a one of the people whose name is not above the title on any film I've ever worked on, who's buried down 25, seconds or minutes into the credits, where the only ones left looking at it are me and my parents when it goes by. I like the fact that for those involved in working on this movie, that they are afforded the opportunity to have their work recognized by the filmmakers doing it, and I just want to applaud them for that.
Agreed.
I think it shows great respect for the people who worked so hard on this movie.
And it's a good reward for getting a movie like this done with that relatively few people.
Yes.
Okay, cool. Well, thanks, David. Is there anything you want to tell us all about before we sign off?
No, if people want to get in contact with me, I'm on Pounce, I'm on Facebook, and this week I'll be releasing a animation exporter for Maya, for Modo. If anybody's interested, they can go to modomotion.com. That'll be released on Friday, February 15th, free to the public, for any of the visual effects artists out there who want to use it. And that's about it.
Great. Thank you very much, David, and thanks everyone for listening. We'll see you the next time around.